From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll hear the latest on Boston University's dismissal of On Point host Tom Ashbrook. Also, Senator Elizabeth Warren defended her Native American heritage in a surprise speech today.
You won't find my family members on any rolls, and I'm not enrolled in a tribe. And I want to make something clear. I respect that distinction.
This could have something to do with her future political career. We'll find out more. Also, the New Hampshire woman who won the Powerball lottery is fighting in court to remain anonymous and still receive her winnings.
She was very upset because she didn't know that she lost her right of anonymity by signing the ticket.
Plus, our weekly sports segment with Bill Littlefield. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. This afternoon, we start the show with some news coming out of our own shop. Boston University, which owns WBUR's license, has dismissed Tom Ashbrook, the longtime host of WBUR's call-in radio program On Point. The decision was made after an independent review verified claims filed in December that Ashbrook had created an abusive work environment. A second investigation to determine if he had violated the university's sexual misconduct policies, which are also those federal Title IX policies, found that his conduct may have been unwelcome, but it was not sexual in nature and did not constitute sexual harassment. The common finding in both the investigations, according to BU, is that Ashbrook's conduct had a harmful effect on the staff at On Point. Ashbrook has been on leave during the inquiry, which began in early December. The investigators from both firms talked with about 60 people, including those who made the complaints, other current or past On Point employees. They spoke with station management and with Ashbrook himself. Both reports also stated that WBUR management was aware of Mr. Ashbrook's behavior and repeatedly talked with him about it, but they were unsuccessful in changing his behavior. In a statement, Tom Ashbrook says he is deeply disappointed by the decision, which he believes is profoundly unfair both to him and the listeners who've been such a part of On Point. He also said he's learned a great deal about himself over the past couple of months and, quote, there are things I would do differently in the future. Ashbrook's lawyer also issued a statement. We have a recording of Laura Student, a partner at Burns & Levinson.
There was an independent investigation conducted by Boston University that concluded that Tom Ashbrook did not engage in any form of sexual harassment, contrary to the initial media coverage of this matter. Boston University's decision, it appears, is based solely on issues with Mr. Ashbrook's management of his team, which the university failed to address in a timely and professional manner, and had done that, it would have resolved those issues. Given the university's failure to appropriately address these management issues at that time, it's fundamentally unfair that Boston University would take such a dramatic action against an employee solely based on his management interaction with his team. The workplace issues raised could clearly have been addressed without this drastic action. Mr. Ashbrook is extremely upset.
That is Laura Studden, a partner at Burns & Levinson, and Tom Ashbrook's lawyer in these cases. We'll hear more from Tom Ashbrook's statement in a moment. In the studio, WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger, who has been covering the story of the allegations against Tom Ashbrook and now BU's decision. Martha, there was a staff meeting that began about an hour ago. Can you talk about anything that came out of that?
Well, I think I didn't go. It was off the record, and so I couldn't be in the position of hearing things I couldn't report. But what I heard about the meeting was that it was somber, that people are sad about what appears to be a stain on WBUR and management. There are many people in the station who feel both ways, Jill, that Tom's actions did not warrant dismissal, and those who feel that they did. So the response to the decision will vary depending on who you're talking to about the outcome. People were told some of what we saw in the statement from Boston University that management consultants will be here to speak to people, to work on repairing some of the problems with reporting allegations and feeling like they are adequately addressed.
Is there a sense of why that hasn't happened until now, either between December when the allegations were made in various different days and weeks, or even when BU management and WBUR, or at least WBUR, may have been aware of behavior? Is there any conversation yet about why that didn't happen or any earlier than now?
So I'll take the pre-December part of the question first, which is managers acknowledge that they knew about the complaints of abusive behavior directed at Tom. They say they tried to address it, and that part of the reason that they felt they needed to dismiss him was that they had tried to fix that culture, those cultural problems, those behavior problems before, and weren't able to. So now the part of your question, Jill, that's about what happened after December when these allegations were first revealed. And the reason, I might just say, the reason that they sort of came to light in part was that this was the first time, as far as we know, that the allegations were sent what we call across the street, meaning to human resources at Boston University, that they weren't just kept internal within the station. So in that period, the investigation, two investigations launched fairly immediately, one into the sexual misconduct allegations and one into the workplace culture allegations. And the university and the management here at WBUR declined to make any changes until those investigations were concluded, which we have the results of today.
Okay, so now HR steps in and something is supposed to be happening that may change policy, that may change the culture, or we'll see what happens. I want to read another little piece of Tom Ashbrook's statement, because I think there's something deep inside here that I want to ask you about whether Tom Ashbrook is blaming WBUR and BU for the loss of his job. He said, "I believe that WBUR and Boston University failed in their responsibility to effectively address these issues specifically that were in the allegations when they arose, when they could have been more easily resolved." I think we heard his lawyer say some of this too. "When these issues arose, there were suggestions of inappropriate behavior that were completely antithetical to my personal values and my respect for the people with whom I worked. In their decision, WBUR and BU concluded there was no basis for any action based on the review of those issues." So it sounds like a blame at the moment, and I wonder from that, is that where it's left, or is there any kind of settlement that we know that Boston University has been asked for from Ashbrook and his lawyers, or has been offered?
Well, what I've learned is that Tom and his attorney saw the reports and learned of the decision to dismiss him today, that there were no negotiations as part of that conversation. I believe Tom and his attorney are reviewing their options to see if they do have any. His contract runs through June, and I believe he expects to be paid through the end of that contract. But there is no settlement, as far as I know, beyond that.
And are you able to comment, and this is more of an analysis, Martha, than I know you're reporting on the details as they're coming, on this notion that he is blaming the university? I don't know if that's a common way of reacting to a dismissal based on allegations of misconduct.
Well,
of some kind.
Yeah, so I can say that Tom's attorney says both she and her client are shocked by this decision, that they felt like typically it is that management issues would be something that would be resolved, that they would find fixes, that there would be remedies that Tom would participate in, that this would not be a fireable offense.
Have you been able yet to speak, since this news broke around noon, I think, to WBUR management? Do you have any sense that they are saying there's a failure on their part, that they should have addressed this earlier in some other manner than they did?
You know, we do have a statement from General Manager Charlie Kravitz, Jill, that says he knows that they need to do more, that the station needs to do more in the future. I have not heard an apology from Mr. Kravitz or other managers at WBUR. I think there is a sense that there was some level of failure. And you see that in the statement, too, that both reports, whether they were on the sexual misconduct issue or the workplace culture, both reports said they became aware that Mr. Ashbrook's behavior, I'm quoting here from the statement from BU, and repeatedly talked to him about it, but were unsuccessful in changing his behavior. So that's the degree of accountability that we have so far.
All right. Martha, you and I have both been at BUR in different iterations for a long time, and I just...
loved every minute of it with you, Jill.
Like early 90s. I do need to say that, just to be clear to our listeners, that Radio Boston's regular host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is on a planned vacation. I am here filling in. I don't work for WBUR or for BU, though I did work for WBUR for 10 years and was here when Tom Ashbrook started special coverage on 9/11.
Yes.
And it became on point. So I just want to make that clear to our listeners. We know that this is not the only incident in public media or in media of someone being called on the carpet for misconduct of any kind. And again, this is not, according to policy, sexual harassment.
That's
the
right.
Allegations do not come through that way. This is about bad behavior in other ways. The news of his dismissal, of Tom Ashbrook's dismissal, comes a week after an article came out in The Cut, which is part of New York Magazine, dealing with problems of harassment and bullying at WNYC in New York. We want to introduce Joshua Benton. He's the director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard, which is a very important place to journalists and the world. Thank you, Joshua, for joining us by phone.
My pleasure.
Can you talk a bit about what, I don't know if we're stacking it up here, but what it means for Tom Ashbrook's dismissal today, what that means in public media? Is there a way of sussing that yet?
Well, in a sense, it's one of an unfortunate series between John Hockenberry at The Takeaway at WNYC, Garrison Keillor at Minnesota Public Radio, Michael Oreske is the head of news for NPR in Washington. There's been a real spate of men who've been accused of misconduct in a variety of ways, either sexual or more in the lines of bullying. I think it's really rocked significant portions of the public radio system. WNYC demoted its chief content officer recently and is facing, a substantial, I don't want to say rebellion, but resistance from existing staff and a lot of the station's supporters about how do they let this sort of work environment persist for that long.
So, Joshua, do you think that this is any kind of reckoning for public media? It's the beginning of a reckoning that it's happened now so many times, different issues, different types of behavior, not all sexual, as not the case with Tom Ashbrook. Is something possibly going to change? Have you seen that play out in other industries yet?
I do think you can also look to commercial media, and you look at Matt Lauer and people at Fox News. Like, there have been a series of people who have been, at least allegedly engaging in bad behavior for some time, and there is something about the political mood in the country, about the recognition that the concerns of workers, typically female workers but not always, are important and should be dealt with. And it's particularly important at a place like public radio because, one of the wonders of public radio is that a large portion of its audience feels a real attachment to the work that you all do. They feel a kind of ownership over it. And that's really at the core of the business model of a public radio station.
So that does make a difference. I mean, this is public media and it is not for profit. The money that comes in goes to pay for, for the lights and for the people. You've all heard it on fundraisers before. So,
right.
And you've all dreaded hearing it again, I know. But it is what we do. And we've heard, I mean, Martha and I know both have heard from listeners who take issue in a very personal way because they've paid for this. So what is the public response? They expect more of us then?
Yeah, I think the audience cares about your internal workings in a way that they won't for, say, a magazine or a cable network that they watch. I think it's really going to be crucial what the next steps are here. A WBUR leadership really needs to evaluate how they could let this happen under their noses. I mean, this On Point was not a weekend show on a college radio station. It's a nationally distributed flagship of one of the largest public radio stations in America. So they need to ask, what is it about the way HR worked that allowed this situation to go on this long? What was it about the way that a show was structured that a host could get away with the sort of behavior that the investigation found? I can say just from being a journalist in Boston that Ashbrook had a reputation for a very long time as a yeller, as a screamer, as a bully.
He was at the Boston Globe before he came to WBUR, I believe. Among other places, he was,
right.
He was writing as well separately, but
sure.
He was in other media outlets, yes.
I'll be honest, we have job openings for journalists here every so often, and I would often notice that we get applications from young journalists who have 4 months on point on their resume, or 6 months, or 8 months. It seems like a place that churned through a lot of young people, because the power relationships of a show that's successful, that often relies on young staffers, is an unequal one. And I think for WBUR's sake, the answers to the questions that they're asking need to be made public, so that listeners who do support the station and provide that money are convinced that even though this did happen, that management understands what went wrong and that it's taking action to prevent it from happening again.
Joshua Benton, I want to ask you from the perspective of the Nieman Journalism Lab, can you talk about the bigger picture here? I jumped away from the article, The Cut. The article in The Cut that Rebecca Tracer wrote, part of New York Magazine. She wrote last week that this hashtag MeToo moment isn't just about sex, it's really about work. So with Ashbrook among, again, not accused, not found violating any sexual harassment policies, Title IX or BUs, but are we seeing dismissals, a new direction for the Me Too movement against workplace bullying, against outrageous behavior?
I wouldn't describe it as a new direction for the Me Too movement, because I think that it has its own trajectory. But I do think that the fact that the Me Too movement has happened has meant that previously private work relationships, or at least, I mean, not public work relationships, are being exposed to a broader audience. You know, we're hearing about the way that someone like Matt Lauer, you know, deals with his staff and deals with NBC employees. And even though a lot of those allegations are sexual in nature, it nonetheless raises the issue of these power relationships. And that's something that can apply not just to sexual behavior, but to a broad spectrum of behavior.
So, Joshua Benton, we will see what happens next in this company, in this organization here at WBUR, and we'll see how this continues to play out across public media and otherwise. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joshua Benton is director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. Martha Biebinger, thank you for coming in to the studio. And I know you have to get back to your desk and turn out a report on this.
Absolutely, Jill. Thanks.
Good to see you. Martha Biebinger, reporter here at WBUR. Stay with us. There is more ahead coming up. Senator Elizabeth Warren took on President Trump's Pocahontas taunts. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman.
And Massachusetts is represented by Pocahontas, right? Pocahontas.
President Trump.
It's represented by Pocahontas.
There he is, has many times over said on the campaign trail before the election, now from the Oval Office, he's said these very words. Today, Elizabeth Warren, in a surprise appearance and impassioned speech at the National Congress of American Indians, told the story of her parents' marriage. Her mother was part Native American, and the senator's father's parents were opposed to their relationship, so they eloped.
They're gone, but the love they shared, the struggles they endured, the family they built, and the story they lived will always be a part of me, and no one, not even the President of the United States, will take that part of me away.
Why today? We'll find out in a moment. Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, has been following Elizabeth Warren, following this story. He joins us now by phone. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could make it on short notice. Can you catch us up a bit on what's been happening just this morning, and why was Senator Warren's speech such a surprise?
So Warren has been sort of dogged, you know, since her 2012 campaign in Massachusetts over these claims of Native American heritage. She's been a little bit reluctant to engage in this issue head on. And she's not necessarily done a huge amount of work with Native Americans since she became senator. And President Trump has used this to attack her. And so today was an unusual moment. She went to the Native American Congress, which is an annual gathering of top tribal leaders around the country. And this was sort of quietly put together over the past couple of days. Elizabeth Warren was not on the agenda, not scheduled to speak. And it was a shock to many in the room for her being there. And she went and she had a couple of different messages. One was not apologizing for her claims of heritage. In fact, sort of offering a little bit more detail about about her parents and her family and her upbringing. But secondly, she really went on the offensive with President Trump on this term of using Pocahontas to sort of derisively attack Elizabeth Warren.
Matt, I just want to ask you, I just want you to go back for one second. Did you say it was a shock? I mean, somebody from this organization knew that she was going to be speaking. So what does that say about a partnership? You know, is this a united front on something? Are they, you know, is this almost an endorsement of Senator Warren?
It was not an endorsement. She'd been in contact, I think, with several people among the leadership of the putting on this conference. But we talked to people in the crowd afterwards, and there was not an expectation of her being there. In fact, the RNC yesterday put out a memo sort of attacking Warren for not going and not being willing to be before this group. So it was a little bit of a surprise for people in the room to hear from her, but she was well received. She got a standing ovation before the speech and after the speech. We talked with about a dozen different tribal leaders who were there, and the message that she had was well received, at least within the room.
All right, let's hear her a little bit more from her, because during her speech, she does make a distinction between having Native American heritage, which she does still claim, and being enrolled in a tribe.
You won't find my family members on any rolls. I'm not enrolled in a tribe. And I want to make something clear. I respect that distinction. I understand that tribal membership is determined by tribes and only by tribes.
So Matt Visor, she's not backing down from any claims of Native American heritage, but do you think this distinction will matter to her detractors?
Not to her detractors, no. I mean, and in fact, if anything, this animates them more.
Does it? And does it also then matter? And I'll just throw this in at you. Does it also then matter to Native Americans? So go from there. Sorry.
I think that what she said does matter to Native Americans. I think that they themselves sometimes draw a distinction between tribal membership and sort of what they've been told through their families. And some of the people we talked to afterwards said, you know what? I found out recently that I was not a whole, bloodline part of my tribe. You know, that I had an ancestor that I didn't know about that wasn't a tribal member. You know, so that they themselves have these a little bit more of a complicated history with their own DNA. So I think that they understand where Elizabeth Warren is coming from, and they find her believable in terms of claiming her heritage. But I don't think that her detractors will back down on this, because there is not proof of what Elizabeth Warren is saying, aside from, her sort of family, what's been passed down within her family.
So proof is not repeating, acknowledging and repeating that her mother has Native American blood.
Right. There's no blood test. There's no, there's no DNA evidence. There's not suggestion of maybe a family newsletter and records that way. But there's not, sort of this definitive evidence that I think her detractors will continue to seize upon and sort of call on her to apologize for, which even some on the left have suggested that she should apologize for claiming this heritage, which she is not doing. But it should be said that this speech kind of will animate, I think, her detractors, because so far she hasn't been as much of a willing participant in this back and forth. Now she is. She's willing to say more about this. And she pledged today to be an advocate for Native American issues. So she's putting herself very much at the forefront on this, which is different from the way that she has acted over the past 5 or 6 years.
All right, Matt, I want to get to the sort of why now moment. Like, the elephant in the room to me is why. So why today? Why was it a surprise speech? Let's just hear from Senator Warren for one more moment. She again responded to criticism in the speech, this time that she used her heritage to get a career boost.
I never used my family tree to get a break or get ahead. I never used it to advance my career.
Yet, did Senator Warren speak today because it will advance her career in some way? Is this a political move? Is she running for some high office, perhaps, and this is a way of clearing the air?
Yeah, I mean, and they're doing it in some ways it's taken them a long time to do this, to go before a crowd like this. And in other ways, she's doing it relatively early if she's going to run in 2020 for president, which You know, who knows if she will, but this is something that she would need to do in order to run. So it is sort of stoking speculation of her getting ready for more national ambitions. But, you know, a speech like this is fairly early. Mitt Romney gave a speech about his Mormon faith, you know, which at the time was also sort of a hindrance on his national ambitions to explain his background. And he did that, you know, in the midst of his presidential campaign. And Barack Obama did a similar race speech, you know, in the midst of a presidential campaign. So Elizabeth Warren is doing this fairly, you know, early, you know, before she's, you know, made her intentions clear. But it is something that I think those close to her and Democratic strategists say that she needs to do, because this would be a major issue in any sort of presidential campaign.
Right. So maybe taking a risk, but maybe doing what she and her strategists think might be the best foot forward. Matt Visor, thank you so much for jumping in today with us. Deputy Washington Bureau Editor for the Boston Globe. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
In January, the Powerball lottery jackpot hit a new high, one of the largest in U.S. history.
This is Powerball. Good evening, America. I'm Sam Arlen. Tonight we have an estimated jackpot. It is worth $559.7 million. I hope you have your Powerball tickets. Good luck.
Wish I had that Powerball ticket. It's nearly $560 million, and it went to a woman from southern New Hampshire, not far from here. So far, all we know about the big winner is that she's a woman from southern New Hampshire. She's arguing in court for her right to remain anonymous and to have the name of a trust she's established to be public. She could have done that, but the problem is she had already signed the winning ticket with her name. And according to the New Hampshire Lottery, as we understand it, that means she must reveal her identity. A team of lawyers went to court this week to help her fight for her anonymity. Judge Nancy Gertner, perhaps you can help us make sense of this. WBUR's legal analyst, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Judge Gertner, so the instructions on the lottery website say the winner, to claim their ticket, the wins, that is, needs to complete the back of the ticket with name, address, telephone number, and to sign the ticket. So she did this. But did she have to sign her name?
Well, the New Hampshire process allows for her to set up a trust and sign in the name of the trust. I mean, this is really about the formalities of the lottery. And the formalities are important on the one hand because a lot of money is involved and because you want some transparency. But here, the formality, you know, is really a little challenging. That is to say, if she had written down the name of the trust that she subsequently created, she would have been able to keep her identity confidential. But because she didn't understand she could do that, she signed her own name. And now there is a formality, a rule that says you can't alter the back of the ticket once you signed it. I can't really predict where this is going to come out, because on the one hand, when that amount of money is involved, you want to make sure that people dot their I's and cross their T's. On the other hand, it seems a little dopey not to let her.
Yeah. The six-year-old in me comes out and goes, but why?
Right,
why can't
right.
I just cross that out?
Because there, right, because right. there are rules. I mean, I can't predict where this is going to go. So on the one hand, there are rules, and the rules are there because a lot of money is involved. I think that the argument that the lottery is making, that it's important that she disclose her identity for interests of transparency, that makes no sense, because she could have withheld her identity had she simply created the trust and signed it on behalf of the trust. So I think it's really more about changing the rules and some adherence to, you know, formal rules rather than a situation that doesn't make sense.
And just to explain a little bit to listeners, the reason she wants to remain anonymous is fear for her safety and her family's safety. Mm-hmm. She wants to remain a regular person, as I understand it,
right.
You know, to be able to go to the grocery store and not have somebody go, oh my God, that woman has $560 million.
Right. I mean, apparently the Boston Globe reported that the store that sold her the lottery ticket had gotten lots and lots of calls in which people were trying to find out what her identity is. So protecting her identity seems not an unreasonable thing to do. There's a mechanism for doing it. The problem was she didn't follow the rule. And the question is whether the rule has to be so rigidly enforced as to keep her from preserving her anonymity now. And I think that, you know, I don't know what a judge would do in that situation. One part of me says, is like the six-year-old that says, really, if she could have done it one way, why don't you let her do it that way now? The problem is, I suppose, that they're concerned that if people regularly change the ticket after they've claimed it, it would open the door for fraud.
Is it important to parse also what she is specifically asking of the judge in this case, which was argued in Nashua, I believe, yesterday, and it's being expedited, that it is about a language change, I believe.
Right. And I think, you know, as I said, you understand the rule that says, once you claim your ticket in the name of X, you can't change it because that could allow for fraud. Oh, I see you have $500 million. You know, now put my name in. I can see that there'd be a concern that there'd be a regularity to the process, but it's not clear to me that it makes sense in this case.
Right. And I apologize. I'm throwing this at you, not knowing if you know. Has anyone in New Hampshire signed their ticket as a trust in the past?
I only know that is apparently allowable under the rules. So it's really the chronology here. She created the trust after she had signed the ticket. Then she found out that she could have signed the ticket as the trust. So the issue is really not the disclosure of her identity, because there was a way of keeping her identity confidential. The issue is really about, you know, formal rules about changing your name once you've signed them.
Right. And no pushback. And just to be clear, the lottery has announced that they are going to begin transferring funds into that trust if they haven't already, from what we understand from media reports. So things are moving forward, but it's unclear what the judge will rule and when she'll rule.
Right. And if she can already send the money into the trust, then the notion of disclosing her identity seems to me to be unnecessary. Transparency is one thing, but there's transparency in other parts of the process.
Okay. I'd love to tackle another issue with you, something that has been – immigration is the topic, and it's been the topic for on the news radar and in the courts for some time now. In federal court, 50 Indonesian Christian immigrants who live in New Hampshire will temporarily be allowed to stay in the country after a federal judge in Boston blocked their deportation. This has been happening in other courtrooms as well. This is until they have a chance to report, reopen their cases. This is U.S. District Judge Patty Saris, if I'm saying her name.
Saris,
thank
Saris,
you.
Yeah.
You might know each other from...
We do.
Yeah. She says that there's evidence that these immigrants would face, the threat of persecution or torture if sent back to Muslim-majority Indonesia, and she's compared sending them back to Indonesia with turning away Jewish immigrants during the start of the Holocaust,
right,
as we know it. Judge Gertner, remind us what power these federal judges have when it comes to deportation cases with immigrants who have been told by the feds it's time to leave.
Well, actually, as a district court judge, she doesn't have a lot of power to determine whether it is correct for them to stay. In other words, she can't rule that it is right for them to stay on the basis of their concern for being persecuted. But what she can do, and what she did do as a preliminary matter, was to say it is right for them to stay while they are litigating the question, while they are dealing with the question of whether or not they will be persecuted if they return. The chronology is interesting here. These are people who were under an order of deportation, many 2005, 2007. Then that order was stayed in 2010 by the Immigration Service because of concerns about persecution. Then all of a sudden, 2017, under the Trump administration, they are now ordered to leave immediately. And what they want to do is say that between 2010, when you allowed us to stay in the country, and 2017, the situation has changed in Indonesia. Were we to go back, we would be tortured or killed.
Well, what do you make of the judge's comparison to the Holocaust? It's a very bold statement from a judge. It's very emotional as well. It brings up a lot of thought about this country and when we have opened our doors or not.
No, I thought it was a very interesting analogy. I mean, what she's talking about is the ship, the St. Louis, which had left Europe with largely Jewish refugees. This was after Kristallnacht, after it was clear what the German administration was doing.
Is this 1939?
1939. It was clear that what the Germans were doing. And these were then refugees from an increasingly aggressive German regime against the Jews. They were supposed to go to Havana initially and await visas to the United States. Something was going on in Havana. They couldn't land in Havana, and the American government turned them around. Many of them then perished, as I understand it, in the Holocaust. So the analogy is that we have been a welcoming country. There are all these provisions that we have allowed people to stay when there's a real threat of torture. The analogy I thought was actually an interesting one and an important one. Actually, it has to be said that what they're saying here is not give me the right to stay in the United States permanently. They're not saying that. They're saying give me an opportunity to litigate whether or not I should stay.
And as they do not have refugee status. They were not granted refugee status.
They were not. They were temporarily in this country under an order allowing them to stay in 2010. And so what happened here is that all of a sudden, really, it's very, very troubling that our government behaves like this. I have to sort of interject that. In 2017, they get an order from this government that says leave in 60 days. Leave in 60 days. People had been in this country for 15 years and had been allowed by the prior administration to stay so long as they checked in, and they did.
But as I understand it, these hard rules on immigration were put in place under the Clinton administration, not under the Trump administration.
Well,
but were they ignored?
No, the Clinton administration basically took away federal judges' power to district court judge's power to determine whether someone had a right to stay in the country. There's no question that the sort of the bones of a harsh immigration policy began under Clinton and continued under Obama. But nothing was like this. That is to say, what was it, 2 or 3 months ago, suddenly an order that said, leave now. That's the difference between today's situation and what had happened under Clinton and Obama. Certainly, people were being deported, and judges' jurisdiction, federal judges, district court judges' jurisdiction to control the outcomes, that changed. So they have limited procedural rights.
Okay.
But the notion of saying get out now is eliminating whatever procedural rights they have.
So, and we have about a minute left. These are delay tactics. These are delay tactics that judges who do not see eye to eye with ICE or the federal immigration officer's decision to leave now. Delay for how long, you know?
Well, the order that she issued said they cannot be deported until they have an opportunity to raise the question of the legitimacy of their leaving before the immigration authorities and before they have an opportunity to appeal that to the Court of Appeals.
All right. I just want to make sure it's clear that this is a district court judge. There are federal judges who have also made rulings that halt individual and some mass deportations. And we'll have to just watch and see how these play out. Judge Nancy Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For joining us. Always such insight. WBUR legal analyst Judge Gertner will be meeting with you again, I'm sure. Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. As we near the end of the first week of the 2018 Winter Olympics, the U.S. is racking up medals, and Olympic fever has taken the country by storm. It's kind of fun to watch. We've seen great performances from Olympic favorites like the legendary Shaun White and new but equally exciting performances from first-timers like snowboarder Chloe Kim. Joining us, as he does every Wednesday here at Radio Boston, is Bill Littlefield, host of WBUR's Only a Game. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Jill.
It's been a while since I've seen you. You've grown
indeed.
A beard. I have not grown a beard. You have grown a beard. I like it. Bill, I mean, I don't want to talk about it if you do see anything there. Bill, the highlights of the Olympics so far for you as a true gamesman and sports watcher.
Well, you've certainly mentioned two of them with Chloe Kim and Shaun White as far as their performances are concerned. I think the amazing thing, or at least the extraordinary thing to me, is that both of them went into their respective disciplines, their respective events, with more hype than is usual. I mean, ads made about them, all kinds of promotional material. They were going to do this. They were going to do that. And by gosh, they lived,
they lived
up to
it.
All of it. And then some, especially with Chloe Kim. I mean, she basically won the thing before most of the other young women had a chance to compete. It was extraordinary.
There was a triple axel in here somewhere, too, which we haven't mentioned, on the ice, I believe.
Yes, there was. Yes, there was in the team competition, which is, you could regard as almost preliminary to the main event. And so that was extraordinary as well.
There are a couple of shows that people watch, the halftime show at the Super Bowl and the Olympics open ceremony.
Absolutely.
What's your take on the ceremony this week?
I love the ceremony. I'm as much in favor of that sort of thing as anybody else, mostly because at least for a limited period of time, you really see people from all over the world participating in the same event. And it's a reminder that we're not really very much different from each other. Extraordinary young athletes from the United States are very much like the extraordinary young athletes from other places. Every once in a while, you get an exception, like the fellow from Tonga who somehow qualified as a cross-country skier without benefit of snow, a story that we told on Only a Game. But it's a sense that, you know, the world is a big place in one sense, but in another respect, it's a small community, and it's nice to be reminded of that.
It's one of the greater spaces of diplomacy right now, so
we will
point that out.
And it's too bad that sometimes the people responsible for diplomacy, like Mike Pence, sort of don't get it.
Hockey, whether or not our vice president pays attention, you do, women's hockey in particular. The U.S. women's hockey team, is it the year that they could beat Canada?
Well, they certainly seem to think so. And as I've been saying to people who've asked me that question, I'm very much encouraged by the fact that the U.S. team is thinking of itself as sort of reconditioned, remade, and maybe a little bit less strict, a little bit less disciplined, a little more freelance and open than they have been in the past. And I can certainly hope that the result is that they finally win an Olympic gold medal to go along with all the world championship medals that they've recently won.
And among the teammates, there's a young woman from Westfield, Mass. On the team, I believe. I am blanking on her name at the moment, but we'll get it up on the website so folks
can
see.
One of the people on the team is Megan Duggan, who some of our listeners may remember from the Only a Game 20th anniversary party. She was our guest, and a very welcome guest she was.
Great. When's the next... do you know the schedule by heart?
I don't know the schedule by heart.
Let's talk about another sport. Shaun White, the big performance yesterday, of course, after a disappointing fourth place in Sochi, he made his big comeback, winning the gold medal. This is snowboarding we're talking, on the men's half pipe. It was an incredible performance. How did he do? This is last night. How did he do last night?
Yeah, well, it was an incredible performance in many respects. One, it was under pressure. The guy performing right before him had basically given him something to shoot for. Shaun White had to do better than he had previously done on his previous run in order to win a gold medal, and he went out and did it. I think it's also important to note that one consequence of being in the spotlight in the Olympics is that people tend to examine the rest of your life, and Shaun White's accusations against him of sexual harassment have resurfaced. He initially dismissed them as gossip and happily has apologized for that and realized that this sort of thing needs to be taken a good deal more seriously.
Let's listen to what he has to say about that.
I'm truly sorry that I chose the word gossip. It was a poor choice of words to describe such a sensitive subject in the world today. And, I'm just truly sorry.
Sport, life, media, these are allegations.
It would have been nice if he'd also said, I'm also truly sorry for the sexual harassment that I committed and had to settle with the woman who used to be a member of my band.
Well, do these allegations change his career? Does it change the wins for you as a fan of sports?
I can't really claim to be a knowledgeable fan of snowboarding. I'm like most people, I watch it once every 4 years.
Man, you haven't been skiing lately in New England.
No, not on these knees. But I think everybody has to decide that sort of thing for themselves. We've certainly seen charges like this change and end the careers of people in all sorts of walks of life. And so we'll have to see what happens.
We've got about a minute left, Bill, and I want to move on to some local sports. Boston sports, where basketball legend Paul Pierce's number 34 jersey has been retired by the Celtics. Pierce spoke during a celebration of his excellence on and off the courts this weekend.
You know, since Wick called me and said, you know, we're going to retire your number, and I was just always thought, like, you know, I worked hard. I got to the NBA. You're a Boston Celtic. But not everybody makes it up there. And I'm like, how did I get there?
Bill Littlefield, how did he get there?
Well, playing 15 years for the Celtics, 10 years as an All-Star, 2008 Finals Most Valuable Player, played on a championship team. That's pretty much the full boat as far as getting your number retired, and couldn't have happened to a more deserving fellow.
You know, part of the celebration, the Celtics named the tunnel that the players walk out of before the game is the Paul Pierce Players Tunnel. That's a tongue twister. Quite the honor.
Yeah, not exactly the Ted Williams Tunnel, but close enough, and I'm sure Paul Pierce is very happy to see that happen.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you so much for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you, Jill.
Bill Littlefield is the host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on WBUR Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. An artist and an art teacher at Westfield State University near Springfield, Mass., just spent 4 days painting in public a 6-foot-tall portrait of Trayvon Martin, the black teen whose murder in 2012 polarized the country. The performance took place on a campus where last semester numerous incidents of racist messages and graffiti were reported, and that's changed the way some see their school. I met up with the artist in the last hours of painting.
2 hours on Saturday, where I stained the canvas, it was almost...
Iman Ime is taking a break from this 17-hour public art project, 1 hour of painting for each year of Trayvon Martin's life. People, about 30, he thinks, have come to watch him over the last few hours. Now it's quiet. On the canvas at this point are two images in red, gray, and black. A face is painted in oil, and a profile is in charcoal.
We're looking at Trayvon right now in two instances. One where it's just a portrait of his face, and the other one almost like a moment, the moment before he died, this moment of terror.
This painting, a performance really, takes place in a small auditorium at Westfield State University. While Emet paints, musicians flow in and out, some playing without introduction. This piece was composed by Westfield State senior Kevin Mason, who's a drummer. He made a sound portrait using 911 calls from the night Trayvon Martin was shot.
I had a thought in my mind when I heard about what Professor Ime was doing. And I didn't even approach him. He approached me. And he said, I want you to do something. And I was like, well, great, because I already have an idea.
The soul of Trayvon Martin is not alone in this room. The photos of a dozen or so black teenage boys are hung around the room. All were killed between 1916 and 2015. Emmett Till, Jordan Davis, Tamir Rice, Eugene Williams. Emme ties them together in what he calls a very unfortunate fraternity.
I like the fact that these boys are together, even though we're dealing with decades and decades and decades of space. And the students are seeing, like, as they're reading this, they're like, it's the same thing. It's the same story.
This exhibit follows a semester when Westfield State experienced a rash of racist crime. Nearly 24 reported incidents. Racist notes were slipped under dorm room doors and written on students' dry erase boards. One student reported she was assaulted with racist language directed at her. Ime says on campus it felt like a change in the weather. But it's not like this hasn't happened before.
So for everybody who came to me, who told me, you know, this is not the Westfield that I know, you know, I hurt my head rolling my eyes a little, and other black students and faculty members the same.
My name's Julian Flaron. I teach mathematics.
Flaron is white, and he says he doesn't know Ime very well, but he came tonight because it's rare to see someone paint like this. And in his own classes at Westfield State, his students last term came up with mathematical art against hate. Using perspective drawing, he says, and optical illusions, they responded to the racism on campus. But he says this is not a campus problem.
This is a national problem. This is an international problem. And my hope that by, you know, what we're seeing tonight and what I'm doing in my classroom, what we're doing is we're sending groups of people forward who can be the change that we wish to see.
In the last 2 hours of this public painting, the auditorium is packed. Many are standing in the back. And Ime begins to mark up the finished portrait into 17 sections, like the number of hours he's painted, like the number of years in Trayvon Martin's life.
I had loved so
he appears to be crying. Everyone who entered the auditorium was given an envelope. They were asked to open them at the same time. 16 people have a card that asks them to help cut the painting up, essentially destroy it. The other cards say, "I watched them cut." Imme makes the first slice using a box cutter. Ima Imme has plans for the 17 pieces now lying on the ground. Maybe an entire body of work, he says, that helps us all grow.
Is there a way to see this boy as just a boy? He's still a concept in many ways, and he's going to remain one. You can't undo that. What I can do is have a conversation about the problem of how we see him and maybe how we see other black boys.
Perhaps then, he says, the death of Trayvon Martin and the others in this unfortunate fraternity can mean something new. And if you go to radioboston.org, you'll find a link to the portrait in its various stages. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. I'm Jill Kaufman.